सोच विचार के साथ। मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है।
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।
वेलकम टू सोच विचार। टुडे वी आर गोइंग टू गो बैक टू द हिस्ट्री ऑफ पाकिस्तान। वी हैव विद अस याकूब बंगश, हु इज अ वेरी वेल नोन यंग पाकिस्तानी हिस्टोरियन, now professor at the ITU, the
Information Technology
University, which is an up and coming, a very now a well established university. Many of you might have heard the name Umar Saif. It is a university associated with Umar Saif, and Yaqub works very closely with Umar Saif. But Yaqub's bio is long, so I'll just give you a salient features of what he's done. Yaqub has written a book on the princely states and their accession in Pakistan, I think, which is a very important topic. We'll come to that at some point, or maybe cover some of it here. He's also done a history of the judiciary in Pakistan. And he writes several columns in newspapers on the history of Pakistan. And I find them very revealing and rewarding. So I got hold of Yaqub and asked him to help us think through things on Soch Bichar. As you know, our job in Soch Bichar is actually thinking and analysis, and that's what we're going to do with Yaqub today. He's going to tell us several things about the first few years of Pakistan, the first 10 years of Pakistan. I must confess, we all think we know everything about Pakistan, but historians will always uncover something new. So Yaqub, please tell us, why do you think the first 10 years are interesting, and what should we be thinking about in those first 10 years that reflect upon us today?
Thank you very much, Nadeem Saab, for inviting me, and I'm happy to be at this forum, which I think is very important for us to think and understand. I think those are your sort of two salient and important features here. I want to talk about the first 10 years of Pakistan because, as you mentioned, that my book is on the accession and integration of the princely states. And that accession and integration took place, generally in the first 7-8 years of Pakistan. But even outside of that, why I got interested also in the princely states leads me to, one of the seminal books written by Professor Aisha Jalal, The State of Martial Rule, which was her second book. And in that, she actually has this line which struck me when I read it. And it has remained with me since. And that is that, Pakistan in its first 10 years got its mold. She just very, succinctly says that's the mold that then Pakistan followed. Everything that happened in Pakistan after 1956 is in a way a repetition of what happened between 47 and 56. So that's why I think this period is really important. And through my research now, I'm actually really trying to explore the different ways in which the state was, practically, again, to use Aisha Jalal's phrase, conjured up.
Isn't that true for all of us? Don't we sort of kind of get shaped in our first few years of life and then
exactly.
So what was the mold that was set in place?
Yes. So, and the very interesting thing is that, when I looked at the first 10 years, it was really odd that except for Aisha Jalal and a couple of other people, not many people had actually looked into the first 10 years, So if you don't know of, as you have just mentioned, even in a human's life, the first 10, 15 years are the real formative years. So if you don't really look at the first, the childhood of a country, how are you going to understand it when it becomes, a teenager, a middle age, or an old country? So you need to really focus on that. And what I found fascinating was that except for Aisha Jalal, except for Khalid bin Said, who had written in the 60s, no one had really focused in this period. We refer to it, but we don't really understand it. So I've picked up several themes in it. The first was the princely states. The second that I've picked up is looking at the Constituent Assembly, which I'm just finishing a book on. The third was the judiciary also, which I'm currently working on. And I think if you take all of these together, you'd be able to understand how Pakistan was actually formed and what is happening in Pakistan. Now, I can just give you the
example. So you're taking three elements.
Yes.
The judiciary, the Constituent Assembly, and the accession of the princely states, basically making Pakistan a cohesive national state.
Yes.
Aren't you missing some things?
Well, in that, so it's interesting. So I'm not taking sort of the big elephant in the room's name. Why? Because if you look at Pakistan through that mold, you know, through this thing, oh, I'm going to look at the military and the bureaucracy, then you're just going to focus on them.
Because I was just going to say that if the one other person that you could bring in who did something in the early years was Hamza Alavi.
Yes.
And his focus on the military bureaucratic state. And you are saying that's...
I actually disagree a bit with Hamza Alavi's thing, because I think since he wrote, the whole mold sort of shifted to looking at the military and the bureaucracy and the whole Salariat concept. That's all good to a certain extent, but I think you need to independently look at these factors and then understand how the military and the bureaucracy took over. And I think that's a very important concept. I'll just give you one example. So I haven't finished my research on the Constituent Assembly or on the bureaucracy and everything, but I think if you look at these three elements, the military and the bureaucracy are tied into these three elements. So rather than looking at military and bureaucracy independently that Hamza Alavi does, why not look at them in the context of these three big issues? How did they play their part there? And I'll just give you one very interesting example, which, you know, again, would at least question, if not counter to a certain extent, Hamza Alvi's argument. And it was very, very interesting. I was looking at Ralph Brabant.
But first, let's also summarize for our audience the Hamza Alavi argument. I think it would be good if you summarize that.
Yeah, so Hamza Alavi's sort of basic argument is that Pakistan is an overdeveloped state. It came out of Muslim Salariat, which is sort of this upper middle class conception that actually developed in the United Provinces, the Central Provinces, and other bits like Bombay and all that. So Muslim minority provinces. And that Muslim Salariat led the creation of Pakistan. But because Pakistan had a large percentage of the British Indian Army that came in from there, the superstructure that developed in Pakistan was heavily bureaucratic and military. And that is why Pakistan, you know, ended up being controlled by them. So that's his sort of, you know, very succinct thesis.
So it's basically the relatively well-established military and the bureaucratic apparatus that the British left us, that they determined a large part of history. This is what Hamza Alavi is saying. Yeah.
Now, when I read that, again, you know, that is a very convincing argument, and generations actually have been convinced by that. But as a history person, you know, look at evidence. Okay. So the evidence is very interesting, that if you break this up and say, okay, let's take this as face value. Yes, a large part of the British Indian Army did come from the Punjab. But does that mere fact ensure that the military will have a larger say? Hamza Alavi assumes it. So the percentage is high, so therefore military will have more of a say. I just compare this again a bit anecdotally to the home counties in Britain. The home counties, both during the First and the Second World War, and then consistently had at least 50 to 60% of their able-bodied men in the military.
What do you mean by the home counties?
The Essex and, you know, so the places around London.
And the places around London, which had the power base.
Yes.
And
now, the interesting thing is that the maximum that the recruitment level reached in the Punjab was about a third. So if you compare this to certain British counties, the British counties had twice as many men in the military. Now, that mere fact, and I think that's the important thing, that mere fact did not lead to the military affecting policy in Britain. So you just can't say, oh, because the numbers are high, then automatically that happens. So I think that's one question that needs to be asked. Secondly, if you're talking about the military and the bureaucracy, you need to also look at what are the motivations of the people there. You know, like your dad actually was a part of the civil service of Pakistan. I was just reading Ralph Brabant's papers, who was one of the first persons who actually researched on Pakistan. The last British civil servant left Pakistan in 1966. You know, Sir Edward Snelson was law secretary for 9 years, you know, one of the longest sort of serving secretaries there. So you had a very high percentage, at least 25% at the beginning of Pakistan, of British civil servants in the bureaucracy and in the military. They know they are going to leave because they are on short-term contracts. All of them are given 3 years renewable contracts. And right at the beginning of Pakistan, these are the bureaucrats who actually are controlling most of the bureaucracy. They do not have a stake in remaining in Pakistan. All of them end up and retire back in Britain. So to assume that the bureaucracy was kind of, you know, automatically functioning in this, in this mold of taking up control. These British bureaucrats, you know, a lot of them left in 51, others left in 54, and only five or six then remained afterwards. So just to assume that these bureaucrats would want to take over control, but for whom? So you have a large percent of the bureaucracy that actually has no stake in Pakistan. It's just there because they are contracted to do certain things. The same thing is with the military. The Pakistan Army's chief till 1951 is an Englishman. The Pakistan Navy and the Air Force have a British chief till 1957. And they then retire again back in Britain. So why would they have a vested interest in controlling Pakistan? Because one day they will leave, and they know that, and they do, and they do leave. So just to assume that Pakistan inherited a state structure and it had these kinds of people, and therefore it just kept replicating itself, is, I think, one very simplistic way of looking at it. So therefore we need to, again, you know, go back to look at the politics and the developing, you know, really, as Ashish Jalal says, you know, how the country was actually conjured up. So it's at some level, it's like this.
So summarize the Jalal thesis. What is the Jalal thesis?
So Ashish Jalal sort of looks at how the political economy of defense, how that kind of, you know, that's one of her arguments. She has several in her book, but how the political economy of defense actually led the military to take over a lot of power. And that was then coupled with the weakness of the politicians. So it's not as if that one day, you know, Pakistan is made and the military says we are the big wigs here. You know, if you remember, there's this very interesting quotation when I think someone asked Ayub Khan about, you know, why are you taking over so much power? And he actually said, you know, I'm the person who actually brings home the butter. You know, if you let him bring home the butter, then he'll decide who has breakfast.
So basically, they filled a vacuum left by the politicians.
Yes.
Okay.
And I think so. That's, you know, one of the arguments. So therefore, you need to look at, well, why is it that the politicians had that vacuum? And that's where you know, I'd sort of bring in the princely states, because if you look at West Pakistan, you know, at that time, of course, we tend to forget that there was East and West Pakistan. What is now Bangladesh was Pakistan, but we don't really talk about it. But that side, if you just look at West Pakistan. What is now West Pakistan, over 50% of its land territory were princely states.
50%?
Over 50%.
This is Bahawalpur?
This is Bahawalpur and Khairpur. Uh-huh. So basically, if Bahawalpur and Khairpur had not joined Pakistan, the rail link between Lahore and Karachi would have been broken, because the rail link goes through Bahawalpur and through Khairpur. Practically all of Balochistan except the Chagi district. And the Mari and the Bukti area, so about 90% of what we have in Balochistan, and then in the north there were four princely states: Swat, Dir, Chitral, and Amb. So that's practically all of the Malakand division and a bit of the Hazara division, and then you had near the Gilgit Agency, Hunza and Nagar. So these, you know, princely states actually were a huge chunk of land, territory, and interestingly, all except Swat and Amb were on the borders. So these were very critical states, and I first looked into, well, how did they become a part of Pakistan? So if you look at the map of Pakistan, you know, erroneously, everyone shows the full West Pakistan. On the 15th of August, when Pakistan was actually created, it was not that full. It didn't even have a rail link between Lahore and Karachi working properly. They had to have negotiations with both Bahawalpur and Khairpur for that to happen, till both of them acceded in the first week of October. And if you look at the princely states, that is where the power begins to shift. Now, why does it begin to shift? A couple of reasons. First, when you're negotiating with the princely states, and you can sort of mirror it with India. In India, as soon as a princely state acceded to India, they were required to do a couple of things. They were required to democratize, and the prince was required to become a constitutional head and not to have full reigning power. So the prince was technically the sovereign, but had to become a constitutional monarch and had to have full democratic elections. This was a sine qua non. You know, Nehru approved of it, and Sardar Patel practically rammed it down their throats. In Pakistan, it was the complete opposite. Now, the reason for that was that in India, all the princely states that had acceded to India had branches of the Indian National Congress in all these princely states. But in Pakistan, the All India Muslim League did not have any branches in any of the princely states all throughout India. That was a matter of policy decided by Jinnah, that the princely states would be left alone. Largely, this was a result of the fact that most of the top benefactors of the Muslim League were princes, and they didn't want to have a people's movement against the princes. So let's say, you know, Bahawalpur and Khairpur want to have elections. Who's going to get elected there? Because, you know, you don't have the Muslim League present there. So the politicians don't want democracy to come into these areas, which again is completely opposite to the reason why Pakistan was actually created. And if you don't have democracy coming in, you won't have elected politicians. Who would you have running the affairs? Then you have to appoint bureaucrats. And Khairpur is a really fascinating example, because they got a middle ranking bureaucrat who was the chairman of the Delhi, who was the administrator of the Delhi Municipal Corporation. He became the first chief minister of Khairpur. And even when they had elections, they got the bureaucrat elected, so to speak. You know, not really elected, but he was appointed. But, you know, they said, well, he has the confidence of the assembly. So 1948 actually becomes the period when the bureaucrats actually begin to take over, not because the bureaucrats want to take over. It's because the politicians are very unsure about their political existence. Again, the Muslim League didn't really have a lot of sway in large parts of West Pakistan. The Punjab was, you know, had only once voted for the Muslim League. The frontier had never voted for the Muslim League. And in Sindh, it was practically Ghulam Hussain Hidayatullah who actually controlled the Muslim League. So you don't really have Muslim League going down through the roots. And therefore, they're very unsure why should there be elections. That's one of the reasons Pakistan did not have a national election till 1970. Because the politicians would never show. So the military...
No, but this is, hang on. How much of it is due to the fact that the Congress was a very well-organized political party with deep history and a lot of very, very capable leaders, not just Gandhi and Nehru, but depth in the leadership. In Pakistan, it was Jinnah, it was a young league, which kind of started in 1906, but then faltered, never really went anywhere, and really took off after Jinnah came in, I guess, 1940 or something. Is that correct? I'm just reading casual history.
No, true. I think what was the issue with the Muslim League, and it really comes to head. So Jinnah is back in the teens and is a rising star of the Congress party. And most probably he was going to be elected the Congress president, but then Gandhi comes. And if you look at their discussion in 1920 Nagpur Congress, that's when Jinnah resigns from the Congress and only becomes a member of the Muslim League. It is fascinating. It is over the fact, are we going to include people in the movement? And Gandhi says, you cannot run an independence movement of elites. You have to include the people. And Jinnah says, no, we don't need to include the people. We need to, you know, keep it away from them because they are not organized. They don't have clue what they're doing, blah, blah, you know. So, of course, he had his reasoning. But I think that one thing differentiates the Congress and the Muslim League, because what Gandhi did after 1920 and the vote that actually said, yes, we need to include the people, because, you know, till 1920, the Congress was an elite party also. So what Gandhi did was then he created branches from the village upwards and on the basis of language. So you had the huge Bombay presidency. You know, Bombay presidency had Sindh in it, had Gujarat in it, had Maharashtra in it, had lots of people speaking different languages. So he organized the Congress committees according to language and from village upwards. So 1920s, 30s, 40s, they had 25 years of experience of actually getting leaders from the village level up, elected to the All India Congress Committee and then to the Congress Working Committee. The Muslim League never had that.
So Gandhi organized the party as a grassroots party.
Yeah.
And the elite party was already established in the early days. So they had all these Ambedkar, Patel. I mean, I can count so many leaders in the Muslim and in the Congress who actually had written books, who actually were very well-established intellectuals. In the Muslim League, we don't have that, do we?
That's, again, a very, very interesting part. So a lot of the intellectual thinking of the Muslim League comes out of the Aligarh school, comes out of Sir Sayyid Ahmed Khan. But what's really fascinating is that even though the intellectual grounding is there, you don't see it. No one would easily accept the fact when you say, oh, Jinnah was following what, you know, Sir Sayyid had actually begun. Even though the whole idea practically, I think, of the creation of Pakistan is very much grounded in the modernist Islamic concept conceptions of Sir Sayyid Ahmed Khan. And I think the problem with that is really exactly what you identified. They might have thought that. They never wrote anything about it. And that's one of the problems that, you know, when Pakistan was actually created, you know, now you have a country, what to do with it, you know? And there was this very interesting article once I was reading that someone actually did go up to Liaquat Ali Khan and said, well, you know, you actually led the Pakistan movement, you know, Tehreek-e-Pakistan, right? But now it's been created. So what's the use of the Muslim League now? Because your aim was to create Pakistan. Now you have created it. Now dissolve it. You know, and he couldn't really answer that because, you know, how do you, you know, there was no future planning. And that future planning is through this intellectual debate, this intellectual thinking. And, you know, and that's the thing. Jinnah never participated in it and no one else from the top echelon of the Muslim
League. Explain to me, now we have these two countries formed. And these two countries are pockmarked with princely states. As you said, we had a large number of princely states. Pakistan is kind of a disjointed place. I think so was India. But let's not go into India too far. But then these two countries are formed. India has an easy path to forming a constitution. And their constitution takes root. And now you work on the Constituent Assembly. We formed a Constituent Assembly, the constitution-making body. And I think it was formed twice or once.
Twice. Yeah.
And it never really accomplished anything. So please explain that. What happened?
The main reasoning, again, for that is that the Constituent Assembly is led by people whose constituencies were in India.
Mm-hmm.
So Liaquat Ali Khan, the first Prime Minister, was elected on a constituency from East Punjab, you know, which did not form a part of Pakistan. Jinnah was elected from Bombay, you know, again, did not form a part of Pakistan. So one is that basic fear that actually we don't have a national
constituency. Who else was in the Constituent Assembly?
All the ministers and these were so the Constituent Assembly was actually formed after the 1946 elections, and they were supposed to meet in Delhi and deliberate on the future constitution of India as United India. But then the Muslim League members did not join it. In 1947, on the 15th of August, it was split territorially, which meant that out of 69 members of the Constituent Assembly of Pakistan at independence, 27 were Hindu, actually, and were members of the Congress Party. So you had a one-third formidable opposition there. And it's very fascinating, the kinds of topics that actually come up. You know, here it reminds me of the fact that, you know, when you were at the Planning Commission, you know, I got that small grant. That paper is actually finally out now. But it was really interesting because when I was writing a proposal for that, I thought, wow, 9 years of the Constituent Assembly, they must have discussed economics, right? They must have discussed property rights. They must have discussed, you know, how to set the stage for, you know, the economy of the country. 9 years, no discussion.
So hang on. So you're saying the Constituent Assembly was formed in a United India colonial framework.
Yes.
Now we get 47 independence. The Constituent Assembly is fragmented, etc. How did we handle that for a start? I don't understand. In 1947, when we gained independence, obviously we didn't follow the Constituent Assembly of the colonial period. What did we do?
We separated the members from the areas that now formed Pakistan and created their Constituent Assembly. So, hence the members were 69.
We just took the same Constituent Assembly.
Yes.
Took the members that belonged to us and set up. We didn't think any further. We just took those members.
Yes. And then the problem was that there were lots of members that weren't from there. So you had to get someone to resign for Liaquat Ali Khan and for Jinnah to be elected from, which is now Pakistan.
So how did we include Sindh, Balochistan, KPK? How did we include them?
That's the other problem, because the member of the Constituent Assembly from the frontier was Maulana Abu Kalam Azad, who was a president of the Congress Party, because the Congress was in government there. So what do you do on the 15th of August? Technically, Maulana Azad was a member of the Pakistan Constituent Assembly.
So you're saying that we had a Constituent Assembly that really was not representative of Pakistan?
Yes.
And this Constituent Assembly now, okay, fair enough. Now, we've seen that it's not representative of Pakistan. Give me its intellectual content.
Its intellectual content is interesting. So it has got...
Because I'm contrasting it with the American Constituent Assembly, the people who wrote the Constitution. They had giant intellectual content, right? With Madison, Jefferson, Hamilton, you know, you can keep naming people, Jay, yeah, etc.
Well, I think here they had some good thinkers. So so they had people like Dr. I.H. Qureshi from St. Stephen's College. They had, you know, some decent politicians like Firoz Khan Noon was on it. Sardar Abdul Rab Nishtar was on it. Initially, Ghulam Hussain Hidayatullah was on it. Khoro and everything. So it did have some sort of, you know, not intellectual heavyweights per se, but thinking people.
Okay. Contrasted with India? India, oh, had, pretty, had to do similar, India had a similar sort of thing, right?
Yeah, but India had people like Ambedkar. India had people like Rajagopalacharya, who again had thought about it. And I think that's the big difference. Nehru himself. And I think that's the problem, that they had thinkers who had thought out what is going to happen after independence. And I think that's the critical difference in Pakistan. The Muslim League never thought about, there was not a single pamphlet saying, this is what are we going to do after the creation of Pakistan. Because, you know, again, as Aisha Jalal says, Jinnah wasn't even sure that there will be a separate country. You know, it's only in March 1447 that the idea of a separate country actually takes off. And it's only in June that it actually is decided. So there's a very short period of time in which all of this happens. So there's no idea. You've got a country, but then Jinnah has to resign his seat from Bombay because now he's in Pakistan. Liaquat Ali Khan has to resign his seat because he's now in Pakistan. Then they have to get elected from somewhere within Pakistan. You know, Maulana Abul Kalam Azad has to resign because he lives in India, but he represents a province that has joined Pakistan. So there's this huge confusion over what to do. And I think once Pakistan is created, the Indian confusion isn't there because they have people like Ambedkar and Nehru who have actually thought about it.
How were they able to form a... How long did it take them to get a constitution?
2.5 years after independence. But the critical thing is that the main discussion, especially about fundamental rights and freedoms, had already begun in 1946 as soon as the Constituent Assembly was formed. The problem there again was that none of the Muslim League members attended the Constituent Assembly when India was united. So they were not part of the deliberation. So they had no clue actually what was happening there. And I think that was a big sort of gap. Then the reality of the fact that no homework had been done once the country is actually formed, that hit them as soon as the Constituent Assembly met, which meant that for 6 months it didn't meet. So the first time the Constituent Assembly actually meets is the last week of February 1948. So the country was created in August. They have the inaugural session. Jinnah has that famous August 11 speech. Then it adjourns. Then it does not meet till the 23rd of February 1948. How is the government run? You know, just by ordinances declared by the governor general. But then they have to call it because, you know, you have to call the Constituent Assembly. And the first issue rises up exactly on the first day, which I think is fascinating. And I'll just narrate that. The first issue is that as soon as the Constituent Assembly meets, one member from East Bengal rises up and says, you know, very nonchalantly, that in sub-rule, I think it was sub-rule 2027, it says that the languages permitted in the Constituent Assembly are two, Urdu and English. And he rose up and said, can we also add Bengali? So he said, you know, the languages, can we amend the rule that says only you can speak in Urdu or English? Can we add Bengali to it, right? This seems to be a very normal thing. And he says, well, the reason is that half of the Constituent Assembly members are from East Bengal. East Bengal's population is the majority population in all of Pakistan. So he just says, well, you know, would we be able to speak in our own language here? The response to that is the most fascinating. And again, remember, that's the first session of the Constituent Assembly after the creation of Pakistan. And the response to that is fascinating. The Prime Minister, Liaquat Ali Khan, rises up and says that he must oppose this because opposition to this is important for the survival of the Muslim nation, not only in Pakistan, but the whole subcontinent. These are his actually words, that I have to oppose this because opposition to this, upon opposition to this depends the survival of the whole Muslim community of the subcontinent, not just Pakistan. But the question is, all they're saying is, can we speak in Bengali? You know, why is this a big deal? And he actually makes it a big deal. He actually says, you know, how dare you even think of talking in your own language in this assembly? You know, Urdu is the Muslim language.
Who was this? Who said this?
Liaquat Ali Khan.
Liaquat Ali Khan, the main leader.
The Prime Minister. Yeah, and then Jinnah is sitting in the chair. People forget Jinnah is sitting in the chair. So when Jinnah actually goes the next month in March, and actually, you know, that famous speech that he says in Dhaka University, ironically in English, but then says that, you know, Urdu and Urdu alone shall be the national language of Pakistan. You know, there is an immediate reaction because East Pakistan is flabbergasted at the idea that they can't speak their own language in a country that they actually voted for. And I think that's one of the reasons. So the first session, the first day of the Constituent Assembly, they can't even decide on language. You know, let alone anything else. And from then onwards, you know, the whole thing gets derailed. The whole language issue really takes up till 1954. Only in 54 they actually agree.
Who sets the agenda in the Constituent Assembly? Is there any agenda sitting down? The way I look at it, again, you have to enlighten us. I don't know enough. I think in India, Nehru, Ambedkar, etc., set the agenda, controlled the agenda, and ran it through.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
If that's right, who was their counterparts in our side of the, in Pakistan?
No one.
No one. There's no agendas. Jinnah didn't, Liaquat Ali couldn't lead it.
If you look at the debates in the Constituent Assembly, most of them are non-structured debates. There is no discussion over what are we going to do. When an agenda is said, so the first time, so if you compare this to the Indian sort of side, the first time an agenda, so to speak, is set is when Liaquat Ali Khan brings in the Objectives Resolution in March 1949. Now, the interesting thing with the Objectives Resolution is it means everything to everyone. And it confuses you so much that you have no clue what will happen by the end of it. You know, a single clause of it will confuse you to no end. So even when you want to set the agenda, you end up causing more confusion than clarity.
Who drafted the Objectives Resolution?
That remains a big question, and I'm still trying to find out. So what's really interesting is that there's discussion in the newspapers that something like this is going to come. The assembly members do not actually know. So by the time the Objectives Resolution actually comes up for discussion, and this is again, you know, the first agenda setting document that they've come up with. Again, it's fascinating, you know, Pakistan gets independence in August 47 and this is March 49. You know, they can't even agree on what even a confusing agenda, you know, so let's not even talk about the fact that it was confusing, but just the idea that there should be an agenda at least set. So they don't even think about that for about 2 years. When it comes, it's really fascinating. Half of the assembly members had gone home because this Objectives Resolution is tabled right towards the end of the budget session. So the budget has actually been passed. And, you know, as you know, in any assembly in the world, once the budget is passed, the 2 or 3 days after that, no one really hangs out. You know, a lot of people who actually come in from faraway places just go back home. So in Pakistan, half of the assembly members had already left for home at that time. And all of a sudden, the Prime Minister Liaquat Ali Khan actually brings in this resolution and actually says that this is the basic framework through which we are going to make the constitution of Pakistan. Now, even that, you know, and I'll just pick up on one, on the first sort of line there. It is fascinating. It says, whereas sovereignty over the entire universe belongs to God Almighty alone. Liaquat Ali Khan used the word God Almighty. Ziya changed it to Allah Almighty, you know, not being sure about that either, which I find, again, really, really fascinating. It says, so whereas sovereignty over the entire universe belongs to God Almighty alone. He has delegated this to the state of Pakistan through its people to be exercised within the limits prescribed by him. Now, this one sentence, you know, it's very interesting. If you actually show this to a lawyer or a judge, they'll get confused because who has authority? You know, so God is sovereign. God does not give the people any power. God gives the state power. The state exercises its power through the people, okay? So you've got God, then the state, then the people, and then there are limits that are prescribed by God. Now, who's going to tell you what those limits are? Is that going to be outside the extra constitutional? And that debate, you know, that's one of the most fascinating debates, and I've just published a paper on it. It's a really fascinating debate just on the question of sovereignty. Who is sovereign? You know, and of course, you know, as you know, these are critical questions in the American American debate. These are critical questions in the French debate. These are critical questions when the Glorious Revolution takes place in the UK. So who is sovereign? Where does power come from? Who decides? That's a very simple, basic state building question.
How many members were there of the Constituent Assembly?
It began with 69. And it ended up being just about 76 to 80.
And the Constituent Assembly was also, it was not a constitution-making body. It was also a law-making body.
Yes.
It was like the parliament at that time.
It was also the parliament, yes.
There was no attempt made to differentiate a parliament from a constitution-making body.
Well, what they did was that it met separately as both.
Okay.
So let's say if in the morning it met as the Constituent Assembly, in the afternoon they'll meet as the Parliament. So they did try to sort of separate it out. Yeah.
Who played the secretariat role of the Constituent Assembly? I mean, somebody has to write the stuff. Somebody has to record minutes, etc. Who did that?
Yes. So the first president of the Constituent Assembly was Jinnah. After his death, it was Maulvi Tamizuddin Khan.
Okay.
But what's really, really fascinating there, I've really tried to get all these all these minutes because these committee minutes would really be fascinating and would shed light on what happened at that time. But, you know, as Pakistan is full of ironies, the problem with that is that all the minutes are actually in Dhaka. Because in 1971, the parliament was in Dhaka.
So we have no record at all.
We have no record at all of any committee meeting because all of them were in parliament and parliament, well, separated from us.
And are you telling me that now in the last, what is it, almost 46, 47 years, there has been no attempt to try and get those documents from Dhaka?
There has been no attempt. I don't think the Bangladesh government would want to give them, or maybe they've just burnt them. I have actually asked a couple of people to find out, including a former foreign minister of Bangladesh. So I hope that we find them. But it was quite fascinating when I actually went to look for them. You know, the National Assembly of Pakistan said actually we were built in the '80s. You know, the real parliament was actually in Dhaka, and since you
so
know
we
they
have
separated,
no record at all.
We have no record of committee meetings.
So how are you researching this? How are you researching this? How do you get your material?
Well, there are two ways. Well, one is the debates refer to it. And the final committee reports are actually presented in parliament. So some of them actually form a part of the debate. So that's easy. The harder bit where I'm sort of piecing it together is newspaper records, because the newspapers actually cover a lot of the a lot of the deliberations of the committees. You know, it took me even, I think, three or four months to even come up with a list of who was on these committees. And that's, again, is really fascinating. We did not have... You know, yes, we did have a dearth of, you know, and this relates to your earlier question. We did have a dearth of intellectuals in the assembly, but that was then supplemented by intellectuals from outside in these committees. So, for example, in the Committee on Fundamental Rights, the Chief Justice of Pakistan, well, the Chief Justice of the Lahore High Court at that time, and later the Chief Justice of Pakistan, Sir Abdul Rashid, was a member. So they did co-opt very intelligent people, very, you know, sort of... people with high caliber. But if your objectives are not clear, you know, so you can have someone like Sir Abdul Rashid being the chairman of the committee, but he needs to know what he's making.
So what was the objectives resolution? Please summarize that.
Objectives resolution was...
That is the fundamental guiding principle that we came up with in 1949.
Yes.
And that's what we should look at as the cornerstone of the deliberation.
Yes, the grand norm, actually.
Okay.
You know,
so please summarize
And the Supreme Court in several judgments has actually called it the grand norm. I think the objectives resolution was actually there to make everyone happy without saying anything. And its aim was to just muddle the... water so much that no one has a clue what is going to happen. So it says, you know, as I quoted earlier, that sovereignty is God's. He gives it to people. He gives it to the state, and the state gives it to the people. And but he has limits. So you don't know who's sovereign, who makes the laws, how is the law made, how is the state actually before the people. You know, that is a very interesting theoretical concept.
Yeah.
How can the state exist
normally
before the people?
Social contract goes the other way.
Exactly. So you're actually putting the whole idea of democracy on its head, but still claiming that you're democracy. Second, it says that Pakistan shall be guided by Islamic principles of social justice, democracy, etc. Now, it's very nice to use the word Islamic concepts, but who defines them? You know, you need to sort of say, okay, book X, we will follow. So at least someone can actually go back and read it. These are the questions. So a quarter of the members of the Constituent Assembly were Hindu, and they actually asked these questions. They said, fine, we don't think Islam is a bad religion, but can you tell us exactly what do these concepts mean? And the treasury benches always said, no, but these, you know what these mean. And they said, can you just tell us what they mean? And they kept saying, but everyone knows them. It's like, no, we don't. Can you just tell us? You know, and that's the real problem. You can have Islamic conceptions of fair play and justice and everything, but you need to define what they actually mean. Once you define it. All over the world.
We have a sense of what our values are.
Yeah.
But the whole point of lawmaking is to actually define
them. Yeah. And if you refuse to do that, then how is it going to work? Then the third issue is, well, you do have about 20% of your population that is not Muslim. So if you're catering for Islamic justice, if you're catering for, you know, sort of Islamic law, well, what about the 20% Hindus, Christians, you know, Sikhs, Buddhist, Parsis. What are you going to do with them? Are they going to get a separate law? Are they going to use Islamic law? But how can they use Islamic law because they are not Muslims? Again, no clarity on that.
Okay.
So you have zero clarity on the system of governance. You know, again, Pakistan was officially called a parliamentary democracy. But in a parliamentary democracy, parliament is sovereign, right? You have no clue who is sovereign in this dispensation. You don't have a clue who has the right to actually create laws. Even when you want to create laws, let's say that's settled, fine. Even if you want to create laws, what kind of Islamic laws are you going to create? Are you going to include the non-Muslims in it? You know, one of the most fascinating aspects of the debate, and I'm shocked that no one up till now had actually picked it up, and I have written about it, is that there comes a time when Liaquat Ali Khan gets very annoyed by the non-Muslim members and says to them, oh, you know, don't listen to Maududi, because these people, you know, Maulana Maududi was actually right quite a lot by that time. So the Hindu members of parliament were reading him in the newspapers, and they say, oh no, don't listen to him, listen to Maulana Shabir Usmani, who actually the Pakistan government had asked to come from Deoband to guide Pakistan. And it's very interesting, very few people actually have read what Maulana Shabir Usmani has had to say. Maulana Shabir Usmani very clearly says in parliament, you know, and it's, you know, on the debates, you know, it's officially recorded, that in a country that we are envisaging, you know, that the government has envisioned, non-Muslims will not play a central role because they can't. Because if you're creating a Muslim state, and he actually, you know, defines this very clearly, and I think it's quite sensible, then only people who believe in that Muslim state can become a part of it, right? Because if you're not a Muslim, then why would you promote Muslim law and Muslim way of life? You know, so he says, yes, they can be some part of it. They can be associated with it, but they can't run it.
Not central.
Yeah. With that, you've disenfranchised 20% of your population, you know.
So what else is in the objectives resolution? Let's complete that.
Yeah. The last bit that's there, which again is really fascinating, that one of the lines also says that Muslims shall be enabled. So not helped or aided or whatever, enabled. So an enabling role, which I assume is a much stronger term than anything else, to live their lives collectively and individually and become better Muslims. So the government now is basically saying that not only will we collectively as a society become Muslims, the government will have the right to individually interfere in your life in ensuring that you become a better Muslim. How are you going to actually do it? So, you know, by the objectives resolution, someone can come into your house and say, "Ji, aapne aaj namaz padhi hai ki nahi? Have you read your prayers for the day,
you know,
or not?"
I'm thinking about it. I'm contrasting it with the Declaration of Independence in the U.S., which kind of formed a formative document for the U.S. And I'm thinking that there the whole effort was in terms of defining freedoms, in terms of defining the role of the individual in the state, in terms of defining the fact that we are all come together for our collective needs, but more to allow our individual freedom to flower. And in particular, this pursuit of happiness and the pursuit of, you know, it's kind of an economic element was built into it. Here I find that from what you're describing, and I said, I don't know much about this, I've only learned from people like you, that it seems that we were preoccupied very early on with two things. One was religion, and the second was a language issue. And we kind of forgot about all the social contract and the kind of Renaissance debates or the Enlightenment debates that we saw. It seems we were not informed by that at all in this process, were we?
Yes, that's very true. You know, when I was mentioning earlier, you know, when I thought about it and said, you know, let's look at the Constitution as an economic document. Right. And I thought there'd be some debate on it. Right. It was 9 long years. I read all those debates. There was nothing. There was no mention of
economy.
Or
even Enlightenment. Was Enlightenment even discussed?
No.
I mean, you're talking about democracy, but democracy comes out of the Enlightenment principle. Was, for example, things that the writings of Locke or Hume or, you know, Rousseau, were any of those informed?
No. And so they weren't. And there's a reasoning for that. And you're very right. We were preoccupied with everything. And even the whole language issue is actually a religious issue.
Yeah.
Because once you give a religion to a language, which they had given to Urdu, you know, this actually reminds me of a really fascinating conversation with a Hindu pandit from Allahabad. And he actually said, well, you know, my first language is Urdu. But if Urdu is a Muslim language, then how can I speak I speak it. And, you know, even now the Hindu pundits of Allahabad actually speak better Urdu than any Muslim, perhaps, you know, around them. So it's not that easy to give a language a religion. So the whole language issue also came in from the fact and saying that, you know, once you have a Muslim language, then you don't need any other language, because every other language is then subservient to this Muslim language. And I think we were preoccupied with religion, and I think that kind of informed everything. But even when you look at the, you know, you were comparing us to the US Declaration of Independence or the Constitution, you know, it actually begins, or even the Indian one, "We the people." Mm. You know, it says the people have come together and have said that.
Yeah.
The Pakistani one doesn't. You know, the Pakistani one says, you know, where is sovereignty over the entire universe?
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting, when this was being discussed, this was compared to other constitutions. Mm-hmm. Now, the Irish constitution also mentions God,
mm-hmm.
but it says God has given the people sovereignty. So, you know, yes, it mentions God, but then it clarifies it and says, yes, God is sovereign over the entire universe. And I think any religious person, or even a, I don't think it's a huge issue, because, you know, even if you're not religious, what difference does it make? But it needs to be very clear where the sovereignty rests, right? And the Irish constitution, even though it mentions God, I think the Italian one does also, but it says the God's sovereignty is exercised by the people of this, you know, nation. And I think that then clarifies this, which that clarity isn't here. But I think one of the reasons why they do not engage with the Lockean concept, with the idea of a social contract and everything, is that Pakistan, and this is repeated by Jinnah and Liaquat quite a bit, that Pakistan wants to create a via media, a third way.
Mm.
So it says that the West is bad. It says that communism is bad. And it says we will give you a third way, a better way. So they do not want to engage with the debate that's happening in the West. They don't want to engage with the debate that's happening in the communist world. They want to forge their new way. Now, the problem with that is, yes, that's all good and, you know, good and exciting. But for that, you need two things are important. First is that your whole structure of government is following the West.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you are a constitutional monarchy, actually, and you are a parliamentary democracy. So your whole structure is actually based on the social contract theory, and you are not even discussing it. So, you know, that's one huge problem.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, you know, and you've mentioned this earlier, you need then a very important intellectual reservoir that actually looks into these issues, because these are not easy issues. You are trying to practically create a new theory of governance, you know, in a country that is split by so many things.
So, and let's look at the intellectual reservoir. Now, in from what I hear from you, I keep hearing the term Malvi or Malana, Tamizuddin, Malana, so and so. Explain to me, are these Malanas the same Malanas that we see today, or are they different? I mean, the Maulana who's holding up Faizabad today. I mean, I'd hate to have him writing the constitution. So, please, how are they different?
Well, they're different. Well, I think if you compare it to the Faizabad Maulana, you know, at least they were quite educated at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the problem also is that the great intellectual rigor of the Maulanas also was with the Congress Party.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, practically, and, you know, for the lack of a better term, that we got the leftover Maulanas.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them were good. You know, Maulana Shabir Usmani was, I think, quite intelligent and erudite. But the problem is they were, again, sort of reacting and acting in a particular context.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those ideas had not been experimented. Those ideas had never been worked on. And, you know, Liaquat Khan actually used the word and said, you know, Pakistan is a laboratory. You know, you can't create a country and treat it as a lab. Because, you know, there will be, you know, mishaps in a lab, but you can perhaps afford it in a controlled environment. You can't afford it in a country of millions of people. And I think that was the real problem with Pakistan. They tried the sprinkling of Maulanas. And then the real problem was you had a concentration of politicians. And I think that tension still remains. Are the politicians going to decide, or are the Maulanas going to tell them what to do? You know, one of the things that Liaquat Ali Khan kept denying but had to do immediately afterwards was, so he kept denying and said, no, the politicians, this government, this assembly is going to decide. But then immediately after the objectives resolution is passed, literally immediately, he sets up an Islami Talimat board of the Maulanas. Now, if the Mulanas are going to tell what law to make, then what's the use of parliament? Let just the Mulanas do it. You know, and that's the real tension now. So, you know, as I say, history repeats itself. The whole tension now is, are you going to hear what the Mulanas are saying? Or are you going to say, no, we are the elected government and we will decide what to do? That tension was there at day one, and that tension remains now.
And so we've got now a constituent assembly that's a hangover from the colonial days.
Yeah.
We've got a bunch of people who kind of, there's also a tension as to in between whether we've got a parliament or a constituent assembly. Are we making a constitution? Are we doing day-to-day things? So they switch hats all the time and they're doing this business. What role are the, is there any intellectual depth in Pakistan? Let's say the universities, let's say the media, let's say public intellectuals. Are there any people who could inform this process? As you said, that even the administration had a lot of British hangovers from the British colonial era. I'm again comparing it to historically to, let's say, Europe or America or whatever. There's always an intellectual ferment that's leading Parliament or the Constituent Assembly or whatever. Do we have any? Are there any key intellectuals, public intellectuals that you put your finger on?
Well, we do because, you know, Professor Haleem comes over from Aligarh and a number of Aligarh and Osmania University and even a very few, but still some from Jamia and other Delhi colleges come. The problem with them is all of them have only studied the Western model. All of them are seeped into. So, you know, they can give you a very good lecture on, you know, the Lockean theories and everything. They are not engaging with them, and I think that's the real that's the real gap. What the Constituent Assembly wants to do is to break away from the social contract theory, break away from the idea of Western democracy. But then you need other kinds of people, not these people who have actually been trained at Delhi University or at Punjab University or, you know, the other universities of the Raj, because they just haven't studied it. And the only people who have are these five or six Mulanas that you've imported. Now, what these Mulanas say, you don't like, but then you can't counter them either. You know, again, the whole tension is you can't counter them either because you don't know enough about what they are saying. So you don't want to accept them, but then you have already told them that what you're going to say is going to become law. So then they expect whatever they have said to become law, but you don't want to make it because that will clip your wings. And that sort of ping pong match then continues. So yes, there are intelligent people around, but they are not well versed with the debate. You know, it's basically saying that, you know, if today they have to give us something to read from, you know, 7th century Arabia and say, well, this is a treatise on, you know, whatever Islamic science or whatever, you know, it'll take us a couple of months to just even read it and understand it.
So we've got this Constituent Assembly that's doing this work. On the other side, we've got the judiciary that's kind of well developed. On the other side, we've got the army and the bureaucracy that's also. So the state is now being run by the army and by the bureaucracy, basically, to do this. What role does the judiciary play? You've been researching judiciary.
Well, the judiciary is very interesting because at this point, the judiciary, again, has some British judges. But the judiciary wants to very clearly sort of, you know, steer the path of the British tradition, of the ideals of rule of law. Again, you know, it's very interesting that for the judiciary, the whole complication is the judiciary enforces law. The law is made by parliament. But if parliament isn't clear what to do, then how can the judiciary enforce laws? So the judiciary is actually left in this quandary where they have very unclear laws. They can't, you know, so some people actually come up and say, well, actually now Pakistan is an Islamic country, so let's use the Sharia. And the judges actually say, well, enact the Sharia and we'll use it. You know, parliament still has to enact it for it to be used.
So judiciary is kind of running the place blind.
Yes, and judiciary is kind of continuing the whole British sort of conception of the idea of rule of law and everything. Yeah,
and the bureaucracy has kind of got independence in virtually because they're not guided by any law; they're just running around with.
And I think so. The reason why, you know, and this I think brings us back to the to the Hamza Alavi argument is the fact that the reason that the bureaucracy takes over is that the politicians have no clue what they are doing. You know, they want to forge this new via media, this new way, which is a bright idea. but how are you actually going to make it a reality? And once they are so confused about it, they have no clue how to go about it, then the bureaucrats say, actually, hold on, we let us at least run this place, you know? And the politicians, because they're so internally divided, have no clue what they're up to, let the bureaucrats do it, because the politicians are not sure what to do. If the politicians had any sense of clarity, the bureaucracy would have never taken over and the military would have never taken over. It's just that the politicians were so confused. Once the bureaucracy takes over, especially from the time that in 1951 when Ghulam Mohammad becomes the Governor General, Ghulam Mohammad has a deep dislike of politicians. And then he, even when there are moments in the first 10 years, and again, you know, this is really, really fascinating. So it's not that the politicians were all idiots. They had no clue what they were up to. You know, of course, there was a lot of confusion, but there were also some bright points. So I'll pick one example. In 1956, one of our prime ministers was Hussain Shahid Sohrawardi. And Sohrawardi actually said a very interesting thing, which again, you know, and I think he's one of the most underrated prime ministers. You know, we really don't talk about it. But I think he was, you know, again, a good intellectual and, you know, his thinking was quite clear. And he said in one of his speeches that, you know, now that Pakistan has been created, the two nation theory is dead. So someone asked, well, what are you talking about? You know, that's the basis of the creation of Pakistan. He said, well, if you still believe in the two nation theory, you'd have to divide Pakistan till it becomes 100% Muslim. So you would have to, you have to treat the Pakistani nation as one. And only then you'd be able to create a consolidated country. So he said a very sensible thing. The only problem was that by that time, the bureaucracy and the military had taken up so much power that, you know, getting a sensible person like him or even after him, Firoz Khan Noon, you know, Firoz Khan Noon was a Muslim leaguer, but he was also a civil servant. He was India's, under the colonial era, he was India's high commissioner to the UK. So, you know, he was a very well erudite, you know, studied, I think, at Oxford.
Oxford, yeah.
And then went up to the bar. So very erudite person. So they had these ideas, but the bureaucracy took over power so quickly in the initial confusion that they didn't let anyone come up. And even when they came up, you know, someone like Sohrawardi actually had hit the nail and said, you cannot talk about the two-nation theory now. But that was too late. You know, by that time, they'd taken over the power.
I think this is fascinating. We have to continue this. I think we've run over our time, but we must continue this. What I get from this is that a young state steeped in confusion, lacking intellect, floundering around trying to sort of mediate between the demand for Islam and the demands of a modern state, as well as trying to figure out a new path for themselves. And yet a total complete lack of intellectual leadership to set the agenda for a new state like Jefferson did or like, you know, Madison or Hamilton did. They were capable of setting the agenda. They had these debates. They had all those things. And I'm fascinated by those, but I don't see that here. And that's a fascinating experience that you've, but I think we still have to flesh out a lot here.
Of course.
And I think you have a lot to tell us. So I'll invite you to do this once again. But I think this is a fascinating discussion. I at least have learned a huge amount. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And as I said, this conversation is not closed. We shall repeat, we shall carry it on further.
Great. Thank you very much.
Community.
Soch Vichar ke saath, mera naam Nadeem ul Haq hai. Aur mera naam Anjum Altaf hai.